I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is journalist and columnist Richard Cohen of The Washington Post, whose new book is entitled Israel, Is It Good for the Jews? We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The long run of Jewish fall festivals is finally concluded with the celebration of Simchat Torah last week, and we've entered the holiday-free season that lasts all the way up to Hanukkah. There's even a special name for the month that begins this week, Cheshvan, the single month in the entire Jewish calendar with no holidays. It is called Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month of Cheshvan. But if you, like me, happen to be in the professional Jewish business, there's something rather refreshing about the conclusion of this month-long overload of holiday happenings. After a non-stop glut of festivals, celebrations, fasts, and feasts, it is actually a relief, a true machaya, to get back to something akin to regular life. Don't get me wrong, I love the Jewish holiday season, and each festival has its own meaning and beauty. Each explores an important aspect of ritual and communal life. Every single festival, from Slichot through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, from Sukkot to Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, has something unique to teach us about how to live life well and meaningfully. But while this is an exhilarating period filled with festivities, it's also an exhausting time with many, many additional demands and requirements for a rabbi or cantor, or both. And that means that when we finally settle down to just regular Shabbat once a week, it is a genuine delight. I guess at some point you really can get too much of a good thing. However, it is not truly possible to get too much Shabbat, in my opinion. The Sabbath comes each week as a way to remind us that whatever else happens in our lives, we can, should, and need to take a full day to focus on something other than work or our daily routines. And that day can become a time of holiness, peace, and spirituality, especially if we do it faithfully and well. And so to play us in on this post-holiday fall morning, here's the newish Vishamru, a prayer affirming the covenant of Shabbat from the band Armon Bizman.
Vishamru v'nei Yisrael, et ha-Shabbat, et ha-Shabbat, lasot, et ha-Shabbat, ladorotam berit olam. Vishamru v'nei Yisrael, et ha-Shabbat, et ha-Shabbat, lasot, et ha-Shabbat, ledorotam berit olam, ledorotam berit olam.
That was Vishamru, Covenant of the Sabbath, as sung by Armon Bizman. Richard Cohen has been a syndicated political columnist for the Washington Post for decades. In 2006, he wrote a very controversial article in which he described Israel as a mistake, and it started an uproar that ultimately led him to write his new book. Find out what it's all about and what he has learned and believes now about Israel when we return in a few moments right here on Two Jewish. Join the Tucson Hebrew Academy as we celebrate and honor an all-around mensch, Pima County Supervisor Ray Carroll, on Sunday evening, November 2nd, 2014, at the JCC. Supervisor Carroll's tremendous contribution to THA as a board member and the work he's done as a great public servant for Tucson and Pima County is an inspiration to people of all faiths and backgrounds. Ray Carroll's commitment to our community is an example of how to make the world a better place. Also at this year's Tikkun Olam event, we're thrilled to welcome back world-renowned comedian, author, Two Jewish Radio Show guest, and Jewish Day School graduate, the very funny Joel Chazanoff, as MC and side-splitting entertainer. In addition to this hilarious comic and our worthy honoree, Tikkun Olam offers dinner, a silent auction, and a great opportunity to socialize. I can personally tell you, it's one of the best and most enjoyable evenings of the whole Tucson year. This is the Tucson Hebrew Academy's largest fundraiser. We'd love to have you join us. For tickets or sponsorship, call 529-3888, 529-3888, or visit our website, thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Richard Cohn is a nationally syndicated columnist for the Washington Post and has been for many years. I think back to 1976. He has written for a number of publications, New Republic, The Nation, Esquire, GQ, New York Review of Books, among others. His new book is called Israel, Is It Good for the Jews? Fascinating question. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
So you have written for a long time, and when you started writing this book, you ended up in a different place than you started. Tell us a little about that process.
Well, you know, the book was, I saw it as an expansion of a column I wrote years ago as one of the during one of the all-too-frequent little wars that Israel has been engaged in. This one was with Hezbollah in the north.
The 2006 of Lebanon.
Yeah. And what I wrote was that I was writing about the plight of Israel, that it was badly located, if you would say, in the real estate business, and that there was always going to be a problem, and there have been almost, I think, probably 100 years now of incessant either terrorism or warfare. And so I said the creation of Israel was a mistake. And what I didn't mean was that it was a moral mistake or that anybody set out to do anything wrong. But it was just that it set off a process which we still don't see the end of. And there's been a lot of blood on the floor. So I was looking at that column created quite a backlash. And so I was looking to expand it and explain what I meant. Because I in no way feel that the creation of Israel was a bad thing or morally wrong thing. In fact, I think it was a good thing, and not a mistake at all, but a necessity, and also an inevitability. So I started writing and reading and reading and writing and reading and writing, and as I said in the book, the more I read about Jewish history, the more I fell in love. And maybe it's just plain narcissism, but I think the story of Jews is just a remarkable one, and this is sort of the theme, not the theme of the book, but one of my personal themes.
You know, I remember when that column came out, and it certainly caused an uproar, because how could anybody possibly ask that? At least that was the attitude in much of the Jewish community. In the course of exploring this, you dug very deep. You don't really get to do that in every column you write for the Post.
No. Well, you know, columns are limited. They used to be 800 words. Now they're 750 words. And if you back up every statement by, go into the background of everything you're writing, you run out of space. So you sort of have to skim the surface and hope that people remember that a year before you wrote an adoring column about Israel, or that I had been to Israel. I've been to Israel numerous times as a journalist. But I was reacting to what was happening then, and it was a mistake on my part. It was just stupid of me not to realize what the word mistake would mean. I mean, it had a kind of power in print that was really startling. So this book was, as I said, an attempt to expand it and climb back off that and say what I really meant. But as I got into it, I got more and more involved, as I said, in the history, and particularly with, when people ask me, what about your book? What'd you find out? Well, there are three things. One is I'm once again awed with the power of anti-Semitism, and quite struck by its durability and its ability to mutate. I think of it almost as a pathogen, as a kind of like cultural Ebola, that it goes away and then comes back and goes away and there's no cure for it. You think you got it under control, then it comes out again. And it's coming out again now. Not that it ever fully went away, but you see an upsurge of it in Europe, Western Europe in particular at the moment, And of course, it's in the Middle East. It's just prosaic, you know. I mean, it's their Middle Eastern anti-Semitism is about as unordinary, if that's a word, as it was in Europe in the 1930s. I mean, nobody gets reprimanded for being an anti-Semite in the Middle East.
We will continue to explore Richard Cohen's new book, Israel, Is It Good for the Jews? And then all of these questions when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have 3 stores. We're opening a 4th in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it. If a person consistently reads and advocates the views expressed in a communist publication, he may be a communist. If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings, or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist. If a person defends the activities of communist nations while consistently attacking the domestic and foreign policy of the United States, she may be a communist. If a person does all these things over a period of time, he must be a communist.
Well, the last chapter in the atomic bomb spying story of the Rosenbergs has finally been written. David Greenglass, Ethel Rosenberg's brother, whose testimony was largely blamed for her execution in the most notorious spy trial of the 20th century, died last week at the age of 92. Greenglass's passing recalls one of the darker chapters in American history, perhaps the coldest moment in the Cold War.
David Greenglass, Mrs. Rosenberg's brother, confessed theft of the secrets while stationed at the Los Alamos atomic project. He later became the government's chief witness in the prosecution of Sobel and the Rosenbergs. It is a stern jurist they face in Judge Irving Kaufman. After administering a tongue-lashing in which he charged them with the indirect death of thousands of men in Korea, he sentenced both Rosenbergs to death in the electric chair and Sobel to 30 years in prison. At the time these pictures were made, Greenglass still had to hear his fate. It is the first time in peacetime that such a death penalty has been handed down.
The 1953 conviction and execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for passing atomic secrets to the Soviet Union rested largely on the testimony of David Greenglass, Ethel Rosenberg's brother, the guy who died this week. His name became synonymous with betrayal in the era of the blacklist. For his role in the conspiracy, David Greenglass, an Army sergeant working as a machinist on the Manhattan Project who stole nuclear intelligence in Los Alamos, New Mexico, went to prison for almost a decade. After his release, Greenglass changed his name and lived quietly until a journalist tracked him down 48 years later. Greenglass admitted then, nearly a half century afterwards, that he had lied on the witness stand to save his wife from prosecution, giving testimony he was never sure about, but that nevertheless helped send his sister and her husband to the electric chair in 1953. The story is still painful. Greenglass, who grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in a household that believed Marxism would save humanity, was an ardent communist when he was drafted by the Army in World War II. But nobody in his barracks took him seriously, much less believed him capable of spying. Greenglass was not well educated, but his skills as a machinist, and luck, led to his assignment in 1944 to the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, where America's first atomic bombs were being developed. After being picked to replace a soldier who had gone AWOL, Greenglass lied on his security clearance report. He was assigned to a team making precision molds for high-explosive lenses used to detonate the nuclear core. When Julius Rosenberg, philosophically a communist and already a Soviet spy, learned what his brother-in-law was working on, he recruited him. Security was lax at Los Alamos. Safes and file cabinets were left unlocked. Classified documents were left lying on desks. Greenglass had no need for spy tricks. He just kept his eyes and ears open. In mid-1945, he sent Rosenberg a crude sketch and 12 pages of technical details on the atomic bomb. That September, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, David and Ruth Greenglass visited the Rosenbergs' apartment in New York. What happened later became a matter of life and death. As Greenglass delivered his latest spy notes, a woman, either his wife or his sister, sat at a Remington typewriter and typed them out. The significance of that act did not become evident for 5 years. By then, the Soviet Union, once America's ally, had become a Cold War foe. Witch hunts for suspected communists were underway and spy networks were being rolled up. Klaus Fuchs, a physicist who'd worked at Los Alamos, was caught. He named a guy named Harry Gold as a courier. Gold named the Greenglasses and the Rosenbergs, who were arrested in 1950. Greenglass admitted passing secrets to Julius Rosenberg, but refused at first to implicate his sister, Ethel Rosenberg. But just before the trial, Greenglass changed his story. He was told that Ruth had informed FBI agents that Ethel had typed his notes. So he supported his wife's account and agreed to testify against his sister and her husband. Greenglass was under huge pressure. He had not yet been sentenced, and his wife, the mother of his two small children, faced possible prosecution, though her role had been minimal. In federal court in Manhattan in 1951, Greenglass's testimony, corroborated by his wife's, clinched the case against Julius Rosenberg and implicated Ethel Rosenberg. Referring to Ethel Rosenberg during the case in ringing phrases, the chief prosecutor, Irving Sapol, declared, "Just so had she, on countless other occasions, sat at that typewriter and struck the keys, blow by blow, against her own country, in the interests of the Soviets." The jury found the Rosenbergs guilty of espionage, and the presiding judge, Irving Kaufman, sentenced them to death. Appeals failed. The Rosenbergs, who rejected all entreaties to name collaborators and insisted they were not guilty, were executed at Sing Sing, June 19, 1953. It is notable that just about everybody in the case seemed to be Jewish. The Rosenbergs and Greenglasses, of course, co-conspirator Irving Sobel, but also the prosecutor, Sapol, and the judge, Kaufman. Just 8 years after the end of the Holocaust, and at a time when anti-Semitism was rampant in the United States, this was a great challenge for the American Jewish community. Because of David Greenglass's testimony against Ethel Rosenberg, Ruth Greenglass was not prosecuted. David Greenglass was sentenced to 15 years in prison, was released in 1960 after 9.5 years. He rejoined his wife, and for decades they lived quietly in New York under an assumed name. He worked as a machinist and inventor. Whoever typed those notes, it seems clear, with the hindsight that history gives us, that the Greenglass-Rosenberg atomic bomb details were not of much value to the Soviets, except to corroborate what they already knew. It also seems clear that Ethel Rosenberg played no active role in the conspiracy. Greenglass is now dead, too, and this sad story, now over 60 years in the past, can finally be set to rest.
First we got the bomb, and that was good, 'cause we love peace and motherhood. Then Russia got the bomb, but that's okay, 'cause the balance of power's maintained that way. Who's next?
We welcome our Mivi Na'an, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And for the first time in a while, we don't say Chag Sameach or Lashana Tova. There's no more holidays. We're through. You have been on an interesting journey in the time you've been in America. You came, you've told me off mic, as a kind of a left wing, and now maybe you're becoming right wing on Israel. Can you talk about that process a little bit?
Yeah, although we are already after the holiday, but you know, Rosh Hashanah and the month after, it's a good time to sum, you know, to sum up the year. And it was an amazing and very interesting year for us as a family. And I told you in a private conversation that when I was interviewed, you know, on the process to be shlicha, like I always said that 50% of why I'm coming for shlichut is, of course, to bring Israel and, you know, to connect people to Israel and to Israelis. But other 50% at least is for us as a family to experience, like, or to explore our Jewish identity and to design it, like, in a more profound way. Because in Israel, you don't need to do too much in order to feel Jewish and Israeli. And it's right. I came here more left wing because in Israel you can as an Israeli in Israel you can afford yourself to be more criticized.
Criticize Israel more.
Yeah,
in
yourself
Israel.
Because you criticize right. yourself. But since I came here, I felt like you know, I saw Israel different. Of course, I'm seeing Judaism and Jewish life differently. So yeah, there is a high chance that after 3 years here, I will go back to Israel and I will live in Gush Etzion as an Orthodox family.
I do not believe it.
You.
That I don't believe. This process is partly because you see how Israel is perceived in America.
Yes, yes, for sure. You know, one. I have a very interesting example. 3 weeks ago or so, I was invited to the U of A to talk in the Middle Eastern studies to a high school teacher, and they invited me to 50 minutes give, like, you know, my
perspective,
the Israeli perspective on the current situation right now. And after me spoke like a Palestinian professor. So and I talked and I gave, like, you know, whatever about Israel. And after I finished and I stayed to hear the Palestinian, and it was amazing to see. You know, she gave all the fact about Israel, but, you know, she missed here, you know, one sentence and one fact. And then I saw the how you can create easily. You can bring out so-called the facts, but easily you can build, like, a different picture about Israel. And that's what, you know, that's why I saw, I know the real picture because I lived 40 years in Israel. And when I came here, I see more and more people who see, you know, just a very narrow angle of Israel. And that's drive me crazy,
right.
And make me feel that I need much more to protect Israel and to show the other aspect of Israel that I took for granted. But doesn't need to be that. So that's why I fell in love again with my own country. And I appreciate much more, in terms of Israel, I appreciate much more the miracle called Israel. And I appreciate even much more Jews who lives out of Israel and doing so much in order to keep, you know, Jewish life. Because after a year trying to live some Jewish life, I can really appreciate the effort.
Great explanation, and we'll continue to revisit this theme, I think, over time. Thanks, Oshrat.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You are about to embark on a trip to the Caribbean, a place that people don't think of as Jewish, and yet it was early in its settlement period, and there are some really old and interesting Jewish communities there. Let's talk about Jews in the Caribbean.
Okay, but actually, much as I hate to correct a rabbi,
oh no,
I'm going to Amsterdam for the world premiere of a movie about the Jewish community in Curacao,
okay,
which is in the Caribbean. It's
one
of the...
Why should you not want to correct a rabbi? Every other Jew ever born does.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. So I guess it's an occupational hazard.
Indeed.
For you guys. So there are these three Dutch islands, the ABCs, Aruba, Bonaire, and Curacao. And Curaçao has indeed one of the oldest Jewish communities, if not arguably the oldest Jewish community in the Western Hemisphere. And I think I once talked even on your show about the fact that the beautiful hardwood floor of this very old synagogue is covered with white sand.
Right.
As a reference to the biblical verse in the book of Genesis where God and Abraham are having this discussion, and God says, if you do what I ask, I will make your descendants as countless as the stars in the sky and the sands on the seashore.
Right, they do the same thing in St. Thomas, you know, the sands of the
white
sea.
White sand Jews are covering the floor.
Yeah, it's
cool.
Beautiful.
So, okay, the story is that I have a really good friend who is a colleague in the U.S. Diplomatic Service who was born and partially raised in Curaçao and partially raised in New York and is totally trilingual in all three languages of Curaçao, or in fact four, which are Dutch, Papiamento, English, and Spanish. And Mark is totally at home in all those languages. His parents were part of the wave of Jewish immigrants, basically refugees, on the eve of the Holocaust who sought refuge from the Dutch government and were encouraged to settle in these Dutch islands, in part because the historic Jewish community there had dwindled. So Mark knew about the history of his family's presence in Curaçao because it only dates from the 1930s, but he was very interested in finding out more about his family's presence in what is today Ukraine and what was at that time Romania. And in fact, it was a province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and it goes way, way back. And he did a trip to find the graves and the homes, if possible, of his great-grandparents and further back. And it was a very moving story. And at the same time, one of his childhood friends from Curaçao did a similar trip to find his ancestral home in Belarus. So this is goes back to what we said, I think, during our last show or maybe two shows ago about the fact that most American Jews who talk about their ancestors having come from Russia really mean countries that were once part of the Tsarist Empire
Ukraine,
but are now Ukraine,
Russia,
Moldova, Belarus, right. Lithuania, whatever. So anyway, the story of the Jews of Curaçao became a beautiful coffee table book, first in Dutch, then in English, called A Shtetl in the Caribbean. And obviously there was a much bigger market in the English language edition than in the Dutch language edition. But, and I guess we'll get to this next week since we're running out of time, but long story short, the book became a movie, and that will lead us into our next conversation.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's now time for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Toward the end of the Shabbos morning service, Rabbi Goldstein asks his congregation, "So, how many of you have forgiven your enemies?" Most of them hold up their hands. Rabbi Goldstein repeats the question. How many of you have forgiven your enemies? Just about everybody raises their hand this time, except one elderly guy, Mr. Steinberg. Mr. Steinberg, says Rabbi Goldstein, it's good to see you. Aren't you willing to forgive your enemies? I don't have any, he replies gruffly. Mr. Steinberg, that's amazing. How old are you? I'm 98 years old, Steinberg replies. The congregation oohs and ahs. Okay, Mr. Steinberg, says Rabbi Goldstein, would you please tell us, how can a person live 98 years and not have an enemy in the world? The old man slowly stands, faces the congregation, and says simply, I've outlived all the momsers. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. You see, a momser is Yiddish for a jerk, or worse. And now, a word of Torah.
Noah! Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all three of whom had an IQ totaling 17. The Bible states explicitly that Noah was a righteous man in his generation. The Bible does not add words. Why do they say in his generation? Because we find out later on in Genesis that Noah liked to drink. He was in fact a drunk. The Bible states it clearly. Later on, Clifford Odets backs it up. My contention is this. If you had to live on a boat with 10,000 mating hippopotami and those three sons for conversation, you too would be righteous only in your generation.
This week in Temple, we read the great Torah portion of Noah, the most famous mariner in all history, a man who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark. We know that the great tale of Noah is shared, to one degree or another, by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, another guy who had to build a big boat to save humanity. There's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a boat with a large number of animals. Comedians like Bill Cosby and David Steinberg love talking about Noah. There's an element to Noah's narrative that plays on the inherently ridiculous nature of trying to alert the world to imminent catastrophe, let alone the impossibility of making a substantive difference in improving human behavior, especially while surrounded by animals. We are mostly familiar with the text of Noah itself. God sees that wickedness and corruption have spread through the world, that human beings are acting in ways that should have been predictable to an all-knowing deity, lying, cheating, stealing, committing adultery, placing lots of terrible political ads against their enemies, you know, the usual. In response, God decides to destroy the world in a great flood, rain falling for 40 days and nights, the whole of humanity drowned in the deluge. One man only is chosen to survive the flood because the Torah text tells us in this week's portion, he was righteous in his generation. Noah, Noach in Hebrew, is chosen to carry the banner of humanity to the next generation. Gathering his family and two of each animal plus seven pairs of each kosher animal, so there's something to eat and something to sacrifice to God if they make it, Noah builds the ark, loads the boat, and goes on not a three-hour cruise, but one long enough to float away every trace of the depravity of humanity. Eventually, he sends out first a raven and finally a dove to see if the world is dry enough to land on. The dove brings back that famous olive branch. They land and exit the ark, and life begins again. Noah, we're told, was a righteous man in his generation, which doesn't necessarily make him a righteous man in every generation, but it does set a reasonable standard that we might live up to. If we can't succeed in becoming fully righteous for all time, at least we can strive to be righteous in our own times. Sometimes that very quest can seem absurd, even comical, but it remains our essential moral legacy. Like Noah, we all must try to perfect this challenging and often broken world, whether we do it with an ark or in much smaller, more practical ways. with mitzvot, ethical deeds, and acts of tzedakah, charity and kindness, justice. Whether or not it starts to rain. Is Israel the shining hope for democracy in the Middle East, the true national homeland of Jews, and the only country that provides a haven for a long persecuted people? Or is it a Western European-style outpost in the Arab Middle East that will never be accepted in the neighborhood? Washington Post syndicated columnist Richard Cohen explores these questions and others in his new book, Israel, Is It Good for the Jews? And in conversation right here on Too Jewish with me when we return in a few moments.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a shocking and pretty terrible development, Rabbi Barry Frundel, an Orthodox rabbi who has been known to the Washington Jewish community as a scholar, a moderate on Orthodox religious issues, including conversion, and a champion of moral rectitude, got in big trouble last week. The spiritual leader of Kesher Israel congregation for the past 25 years was arrested and charged with voyeurism. Frundel, 62 years old, was taken away in handcuffs after uniformed officers and plainclothes detectives from the Metropolitan Police Department searched his home in the Georgetown section of Washington. The rabbi had installed a clock radio with a hidden camera called the Dream Machine in the women's showers of the congregation's mikveh, the Jewish ritual bath. The arrest marks a startling turn in the career of a guy known as a national leader in establishing precepts for conversion and as a strict moralist. Just last month, he railed against the corrosive effect of pornography on marriage. Indeed, his synagogue, Kesher Yisrael, is one of the most prominent in Washington. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew, New Republic literary editor Leon Wieseltier are both members. Former Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman is a former congregant. The synagogue board said in a statement that it had reported Frundel to authorities. Upon receiving information regarding potentially inappropriate activity, the board of directors quickly alerted the appropriate officials, the statement said. Throughout the investigation, we cooperated fully with law enforcement and will continue to do so. Frundel, chair of an important committee of the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, has now been suspended by that organization. Awful story. We'll keep you posted on what transpires. It has also been a banner season for swastikas, apparently. Vandals drew them on the entrance of a Yale University freshman residence hall late last Sunday night, the second anti-Semitic incident at Yale in little more than a month. Previously, swastikas were drawn on a whiteboard in another freshman dorm. And last week, just hours after Yom Kippur, swastikas and other offensive graffiti were found outside the A.E. Pi House, nationally Jewish fraternity at Emory University in Atlanta, as we reported, and on a synagogue in Tacoma, Washington. This past Sunday night's graffiti was found on a walkway outside Durfee Hall, which houses first-year students in Morse College as part of Yale's old campus. Yale College Dean Jonathan Holloway said that attempts had been made to remove the swastikas, but some faint impressions remain. According to the report, several students later drew hearts and other images in colored chalk on the walkway. I condemn this shameful defacement perpetrated anonymously under cover of night, said Dean Holloway. There is no room for hate in this house. The swastika is a particularly offensive and disrespectful image for the Jewish members of our community, but in truth it insults us all. The use of the swastika violates our values of respect, thoughtfulness, generosity, and goodwill. I will not stand idly by when this or other symbols of hate are used on this campus. Rabbi Leah Cohen, executive director of the Slifka Center and senior Jewish chaplain, said that the news came as a shock. Cohen said she was comforted by the support of the Yale administration. She was hopeful this would be the last act of anti-Semitism on college campuses. Please, God. Something as hateful as swastikas on campus, it's not what Yale stands for, its values or behaviors. In happier and perhaps weirder news, new mom, actress Mila Kunis, and her significant other, actor-fiancé Ashton Kutcher, threw their baby girl a Kabbalah blessing ceremony this week. Apparently, it was attended by another A-list Kabbalah fan, Ashton Kutcher's ex-wife, Demi Moore. Demi Moore attended the naming ceremony with daughters Rumor and Tallulah. Demi and her daughters congratulated the couple and had a quick coup over the baby. Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis' little girl, Wyatt Isabel, was born September 30th. The lengthy list of celebrities who practice Kabbalah, whatever that entails for them, includes Madonna, Britney Spears, Gwyneth Paltrow, Mick Jagger, Lindsay Lohan, and Ariana Grande. You know, I've been studying Zohar for about 11 or 12 years, and I'm not quite sure what a Kabbalah baby blessing entails, but it sounds Jewish. Mila Kunis is Jewish of Soviet Russian descent, and the baby is also Jewish, of course, so mazel tov. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Richard Cohen, the Washington Post columnist, who has written extensively not only about the Middle East, but about national politics and foreign affairs for the Washington Post all the way back since the bicentennial year of 1976. He's written for a number of other publications. We started talking about the resurgence of anti-Semitism. So let's explore, because you sort of do it in the book a bit, whether that is a response to Israel, whether it's just always there, why is it so perfectly okay to be an anti-Semite in the Middle East?
Well, in the Middle East readily adopted European anti-Semitism. I mean, there are a lot of people who will say it didn't exist in the Middle East originally in Islamic societies. I mean, it was always present to one degree, but also strong feelings about Christians as well. But with the creation of Israel, it became part and parcel of the political and the ideological dialogue. And so now it is quite common. I mean, you can read, I mean, I cannot read Arabic, but I read the translations of Arabic. It's ordinary for publications, all of whom, by the way, in the Middle East are censored and have the approval of the government, to say preposterous things about, when one thing I cite, it was an article in the Jordan Times in Jordan, which is an English language newspaper, where the columnist said went into this business about how the events in New York of 9/11 were the work of the Mossad, and why is it that no Jews were killed? Why is it that all Jews were given advance notice to leave the World Trade Center? That sort of stuff. Now, that's the craziest thing you can read, because I know of Jews who were killed in the World Trade Center.
Many, just, in fact, including Israelis.
Many. But this is anti-Semitism at its craziest, and yet that newspaper is approved by the palace. I mean, that newspaper is owned by the government. This is a government newspaper. So the same king Abdullah, who I've met on numerous occasions, is very Western and secretly, kind of a good friend of Israel,
right,
permits this kind of anti-Semitism because it's part and parcel of the culture now. and it has been for the longest time. The Germans were very good about, or very clever about, in the run-up to World War II and afterwards, of using the Berlin radio to send anti-Semitic messages to the Middle East. And at that point, already there was great fear of the emergence of what would be Israel. And Hitler and the Germans made a vow that one of the things they would do in the Middle East is eliminate all Jews. And based upon what their record was, they intended to do it. And they had already sent killing squads into Egypt. Oh, they were about to go into Egypt. They were, I think, they had to stop in Greece because the British and the Americans turned the tide in North Africa. But had they gone into Egypt, they would have killed the entire Egyptian Jewish community and then gone up into Israel, into what it says is Israel.
It's pretty clear if it wasn't for El Alamein, there would have been a Holocaust in the Middle East, too.
Yes, absolutely.
And it also seems clear to me that Goebbels' greatest success was not in Germany, but actually his longest-lived success of Nazi propaganda was in the Middle East, because if you read any of these publications, and even in Egypt and Jordan, as you said, Saudi Arabia, and the countries that are more anti-Israel, so much of it is anti-Semitic. You dug in exploring Israel into a great deal of the development of Zionism, Jabotinsky. Talk a little bit about the directions that your research took you.
Well, I had heard the name Jabotinsky before I started doing the book, but I started looking into Jabotinsky and I got fascinated. The people who created modern Israel, going back to the earliest settlers, were in some ways superhuman. I mean, you meet people who did the most extraordinary things. I mean, the one guy I couldn't get enough of was Menachem Begin. I have met Menachem Begin as a journalist, and you just see a guy and you say, oh, okay, that's Menachem Begin. But when you start to look into his life and what he did and the life that he led, and running and hunted by everybody, by the Nazis, by the communists, by the Brits, by everybody else, and then he winds up, thrown into prison camps and experiences which would have killed other people and very often did. And then you turn around and it's 20 or 30 years later and he's the prime minister of Israel. It just, if you look at it and you compress it that way, it seems like this kind of thing that only happens in movies. And the same thing with Jabotinsky, who was a marvelous character, who was a polymath, who could do almost, he could write. He did screenplays. He was both extremely contemporary and in some ways a little bit, ancient. In the sense that he was very biblical in what he thought and what he believed. He was very clear. And, Jabotinsky's view at the time was, what he wrote was, I have ultimate respect for the Arabs. If I was an Arab, I would be behaving just as the Arabs are. They love this land no less than we do. We have to appreciate that. We have to respect them. I'm not talking about population transfers. I'm not talking about ethnic cleansing. We don't talk that language. We talk the language of patience. We will wait them out. They will come to their senses, and then we will be able to do a deal with them. But also Jabotinsky was writing in an era when there were still 6 million Jews in Eastern Europe, or about 6 million Jews in Eastern Europe, and he thought this was the raw material to build, to further build Israel. And, of course, that all got eliminated. So a lot of what he based his theory on, or his ideology, not his ideology, but his plan, just became moot, tragically moot.
You've been writing about Israel for a long time. Now that you've written this book, what's kind of change about the way you write about Israel?
Well, it's already changed. I'm less critical, just plain less critical. And I was very supportive of Israel in the recent Gaza war. I had spent time in Sderot, and I know what it feels like to have rockets come down on you. It's a very uncomfortable feeling. It's no way to live. And I felt at the time, which was several years ago, this was happening, there were three rockets the day I was there. And I felt, what country puts up with this? What? I mean, can you imagine how the United States would react if there were three rockets hit San Diego from Mexico?
Right.
Or, you know, or Detroit from Toronto? I mean, we would go crazy. And so when the Israelis respond, it's because it's appropriate. And people who say that, you know, when they went into this business about it was disproportionate, I don't know what the proportionality should be. Nobody does. You know, should Israel take, you know, be one for one? It can't. It's too small. It can't do that. It has to respond disproportionately. And if your enemy locates its missiles in civilian areas, you have to deal with that. I mean, it's a terrible thing to see. And that's the problem with it. It's totally unbalanced when it comes to the visuals. You can't, you know, fortunately for Israel, it lost relatively few people. And but there, I don't know, can't remember any video of somebody getting hit with a rocket. But there's lots of video or whatever of people in Gaza getting hit by rockets or being killed or being carried out of buildings and that sort of stuff. And that's gripping television. There's no way to compete with that. So on the visuals, Israel is always going to come off less well. But it has. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have a really good argument and a good reason for doing what it's doing.
When you, one thing columnists get to do is give advice. If you were going to give advice, because in Israel they talk about this quite a lot, hasbara, public relations, self-explanation, what advice would you give Israeli leaders now?
Well, I've talked to a lot of people about this over the years because I thought that Israel in the last Gaza war, not so much this one, did not do enough to explain what was going on. I mean, you have to somehow get into a home in Sderot and understand what it's like to be an old person. And if you want to take a bath and the siren goes off, you have 15 seconds, and you can't do it if you're old. If you want to take a shower, it's the same thing. You can't live your life that way, and you have to somehow get that message out, that this is not just a question of some amateur rockets going off and occasionally they hit something. This is a question of constant intimidation and fear and a violation of your sense of security. And in this time around, Israel did better selling its story, but it didn't do any good because the visuals are just so overwhelming. I also think, you know, I mean, I think I've known Bibi Netanyahu since he was in the Washington embassy representing Israel. I think he was the deputy ambassador or something like that. That's when I first met him. And he's very, you know, he can be, I think, too aggressive at times. He's just so sure of his message, and he doesn't understand that other people may not hear it the way he means it. He's just, it comes across sometimes as a little bit too, I don't know what the word is, cocksure, too, sometimes seems belligerent.
Almost seems a little too Israeli, so maybe too Jewish, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, I wouldn't have, I mean, no, but yes, I mean, that's
that's what it's about, really, at some level.
Well, on some level, but you know, I mean,
Of course, I understand.
Right.
I want to thank Richard Cohen for a great visit here on Two Jewish. His book is called Israel, Is It Good for the Jews? It's a great read, and more importantly, explores some really interesting themes. I want to thank you. Are there other places people can go to find out more about your work?
Well, I'm online, and you Google me, and you find out more than I want you to know.
like all the rest of us.
Yeah, right. No, I'm afraid to Google myself. I really am.
I understand.
I've never done it.
Thanks again, Richard. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Two Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be Professor Jonathan Petropoulos, an expert on the Nazi art theft of World War II, discussing the recent discovery of huge caches of Nazi-era looted masterpieces and the process of restoring them to their Jewish owners. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the late, great Ofra Chaza and her classic song Shabbat HaMalkah, the Sabbath Queen. May you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.